WVW Broadcast Network and The New American are pleased to present The New American TV. This broadcast is committed to helping you understand the truth behind the news. Now, here's your host, Paul Dragoo.
Welcome to The New American TV. Today is Friday, March 24th, and I'm your host, Paul Dragoo. As we've gotten in the habit of doing, we're dedicating our Friday show to one topic, and today we're looking at climate change. So for 30 years, the international establishment regime has used its media, academic, and public organs to constantly bombard us with claims that humanity is facing a climate crisis. On Wednesday, we reported a feverish warning blasted by the widely read UK newspaper, The Guardian. Scientists deliver final warning on climate crisis. Act now or it's too late. The story is based on a recent report from the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The report warns that rising greenhouse gas emissions are pushing the world to the brink of irrevocable damage, and only swift and drastic action can avert the coming calamity. And this is just the latest example. Hysterical warnings from Al Gore to Greta Thunberg, to Bill Gates, to Joe Biden, to local newscasters, to your children's teachers have amped up the climate crisis to climate emergency, and then to climate disaster, and climate catastrophe, and even climate apocalypse. They repeatedly tell us that climate change threatens our very existence, that it presents a clear and present danger.
I come here today with a message. As president, I have a responsibility to act with urgency and resolve when our nation faces clear and present danger. And that's what climate change is about. It is literally, not figuratively, a clear and present danger.
That's pretty dire, right? If these warnings are true, then we better do something drastic. Whatever it takes to try and avert this clear and present danger, right? So what do we do? Well, we got to sacrifice. And whether you know it, you've already begun sacrificing. Climate sacrifice is the reason you're paying much more at the gas pump and more on your heating bill. The Biden administration has been curbing the production of reliable energy sources like oil and gas since he staggered into the White House. Climate crisis sacrifice is the reason your food is more expensive. When the cost of transportation skyrockets, everything in those trucks gets more expensive. Soon, it may be the reason you won't find beef at the store. Climate sacrifice is the reason crazy carbon capture pipeline schemes are threatening to destroy fertile American farmland and individual property rights. And if our green overlords completely have their way, this is just the beginning of your sacrifice. The experts tell us this needs to happen or we won't have a planet to stand on. We must completely change and transform our lives, our habits, our societies, and our world. These alleged experts, who claim to speak for science, say that the planet is heating up due to man-made CO2 and other greenhouse gases from fossil fuels. So we must stop using oil, gasoline, diesel, coal, and natural gas. But apparently we can't use hydropower and nuclear energy either, two viable energy sources that produce zero carbon emissions. The self-anointed experts and their media allies insist that America must decarbonize and switch to green energy, wind farms and solar farms that would cover our landscapes and leave us energy impoverished. And while we leave our rich energy sources in the ground to save the planet, China, India, Russia, and other countries continue racing ahead with more coal-fired plants, more oil use, and more nuclear power plants. But what if the predictions are wrong? Like they've been saying for the last 4 decades. Here's politician turned climate guru Al Gore 13 years ago at the United Nations Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen.
Some of the models suggest to Dr. Maslowski that there is a 75% chance that the entire North Polar ice cap during some of the summer months could be completely ice-free within the next 5 to 7 years.
Well, that was obviously wrong. And do you happen to remember this one?
There is little doubt that someday the ice will return. At least 8 times in the past million years, it has advanced and retreated with clockwork regularity. If we are unprepared for the next advance, the result could be hunger and death on a scale unprecedented in all of history. What scientists are telling us now is that the threat of an ice age is not as remote as they once thought. During the lifetime of our grandchildren, Arctic cold and perpetual snow could turn most of the inhabitable portions of our planet into a polar desert.
1977, the worst winter in a century struck the United States. Arctic cold gripped the Midwest for weeks on end. Great blizzards paralyzed cities of the Northeast. One desperate night in Buffalo, eight people froze to death in marooned cars.
Yep, that was a 1970 celebrity warning us of climate disaster. Only then, it was global cooling. Of course, the climate apocalypse narrative has been tweaked by a few degrees now, and now we're in danger of being wiped out by global warming. Climate scam engineers have always used Hollywood's gullible climate scholars to push their agenda.
This is what democracy looks like!
Jane Fonda still pushing boundaries.
We are all here today
because we know what lies ahead.
Lately, a fixture on Capitol Hill, sounding the alarm on climate change. Bringing together average folks along with activists like Gloria Steinem and Hollywood A-listers like Joaquin Phoenix and Rosanna Arquette.
I stand before you not as an expert, but as a concerned citizen. One of the 400,000 people who marched in the streets of New York on Sunday and the billions of others around the world who want to solve our climate crisis.
And how come all the solutions proposed by the climate extremists require giving more control over our lives to the political and financial elites? What are the chances that all the answers happen to make us poorer and less free? No more gas-powered cars. No more gas stoves. No more wood stoves or fireplaces. No more air travel. No more churning up the thermostat. No more meat. It's now time to eat bugs. The litany of demands from our green masters keeps getting longer and more draconian. But do the elites who constantly scold and lecture us on the imminent climate danger and our need to sacrifice live what they preach? The billionaire plutocrats of the World Economic Forum, the Club of Rome, and the Council on Foreign Relations ceaselessly shame us for the wastefulness of our middle-class lifestyle. Meanwhile, they amass more and ever larger jets, yachts, mansions, castles, estates, and investment portfolios. Bill Gates, one of the richest men on the planet and one of the most fanatical alarmists, says the climate disaster is so serious we need to treat it the same way we did the COVID-19 pandemic. Gates and other alarmists suggest that governments may even need to employ climate lockdowns or shutdowns like we experienced with COVID. Meanwhile, Bill Gates flies around in his private Boeing 757 jumbo jet, and he lives a luxurious champagne and caviar lifestyle. He's obviously not contemplating shutting down his own extravagance. Bill Gates is far from alone. Klaus Schwab, King Charles, Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, Larry Page, George Soros, Michael Bloomberg, Larry Ellison, Leonardo DiCaprio, Bono, Brad Pitt, Xi Jinping. The entire clique of global warming royalty are outrageous hypocrites who obviously don't believe a word of their own climate propaganda. They live grand while virtue signaling about climate change. They demand sacrifice from us and the transfer of more power to themselves and the globalist new world order they're building. Another important standout point is about the censorship and reputational destruction the climate alarmists and their media shills have used to squelch all dissent from their controlled narrative. The real big lie is that there is scientific consensus or that the science on climate change is settled. Thousands of renowned scientists, including Nobel laureates, climatologists, atmospheric physicists, meteorologists, paleoclimatologists, and astrophysicists such as Richard Lindzen, William Happer, Patrick Moore, John Christie, Willie Soon, Bjorn Lomborg, Judith Curry, and Tim Ball have challenged and demolished the pseudoscience of climate alarmism. They are crucified as climate deniers. Some are equated with Holocaust denial and banished from the controlled science journals. The good news is real science shows that the climate is perpetually changing and that there is nothing to panic about. There is no climate clear and present danger. Contrary to phony news reports, hurricanes, tornadoes, extreme weather, droughts, and floods are not increasing or becoming more intense. Coral reefs are not collapsing or facing extinction. Polar bear populations are increasing, not decreasing. Claims of sea level rising are absurdly exaggerated. Polar ice caps are not in danger of melting. This, in part, is the point that former Undersecretary for Science in the Obama administration, Stephen Koonin, makes in his book, Unsettled, What Climate Science Tells Us, What It Doesn't, and Why It Matters. Here he is in a Prager video.
Yes, it's true that the globe is warming and that humans are exerting a warming influence upon it. But beyond that, to paraphrase a line from the classic movie The Princess Bride, I do not think the science says what you think it says. For example, government reports state clearly that heat waves in the U.S. are now no more common than they were in 1900. Hurricane activity is no different than it was a century ago. Floods have not increased across the globe over more than 70 years. Greenland's ice sheet isn't shrinking any more rapidly today than it was 80 years ago. Why aren't these reassuring facts better known? Because the public gets its climate information almost exclusively from the media. And from a media perspective, fear sells. Things aren't that bad doesn't sell. Very few people, and that includes journalists who report on climate news, read the actual science. I have. And what the data, the hard science, from the U.S. government and the U.N. climate report say is that things aren't that bad.
The alarmists who perpetuate the panic porn of climate alarmism would like to keep us in constant state of fear so that we cannot think critically, cannot resist their agenda, and can be herded in their totalitarian New World Order. I'm joined by my colleague, executive senior editor of the New American Magazine, Steve Bonta. Hey, Steve.
Hi, Paul. Good to be back.
What do you think of all that, Steve?
Well, let's see. How many hours do I have?
8 minutes.
Well, I was thinking as you were going through part of this, I'm sure we need to talk about the science, but before we do that, I think it's a question of human psychology, and specifically the psychology of power. So at some deep level, I think people who love to wield power over others sense and understand that that will involve privation. So for example, if I am wielding power over you, that means I'm going to take away some of your liberty, probably some of your money, mm-hmm. some of your freedom of movement, and all of that. And I know that you're not going to enjoy that, right? So my first line of defense rhetorically is always going to be, well, there's a need for sacrifice.
Or it's for
and
your
you see
good.
This, it's obviously this is very, very, this is a common thread in all of the climate arguments. We need to sacrifice. We need to, you know, cut back. But you see this in other realms. For example, countries that are on a war footing. The Russian government right now mm-hmm. enjoins its people. Well, we need to sacrifice for the national good. And certainly, you know, every government that's ever spent massive amounts of money to glorify, to build monuments to itself, like Louis XIV or something mm-hmm. like that, the Sun King, probably the greatest profligate in modern times in Europe. It's all about sacrifice for the greater good because enjoyment is always suspect. So that's part of it psychologically. Now, as to the science, you know, we could go, I'm no scientist, at least not in this sense, but it's pretty clear that human activity demonstrably has an effect on local weather. For example, the well-known urban heat sink phenomenon and smog and sometimes the acid rain, other things that stem from that. But weather and climate are two different things. And the fact that they're so often confounded by the know-nothing media and the politicians that are promoting this as a justification for the sacrifices that they want to enjoin on us, you know, really I think is very telling. So it's not clear. Well, two things are clear. A, the climate is always changing.
Right.
B, it is not clear to what extent, if at all, and here I would respectfully disagree with the fellow from Prager, that any of it is anthropogenic, meaning caused by human activity. And now we're talking about global climate. So while it may be true that constructing a city with lots of steel and concrete and all this kind of thing, like a New York City or a Beijing, is going to have a tremendous effect on the local weather and create, you know, abnormally hot conditions in the winter, for example. Mm-hmm. It's not clear that 100 such cities all around the world in the aggregate are going to change the global climate, which is something very different. Certainly not in the way as that natural forces that we still don't fully understand create things like the Younger Dryas and the most recent, well, the many ice ages and warming periods that are well documented throughout the Earth's long history.
Well, let's quickly talk about the aspect of the control, what this really is about. I have here the United Nations Agenda 2030 of Sustainable Development. We've covered this before, and it talks about the 17 SDGs, right? And there's one part of here, a sub-goal of goal 16, where it says that in order to build this, and a lot of this is based on the assumption that there is human-caused climate change, says that we're going to have to develop effective, accountable, and transparent institutions at all levels. So it's not enough that of all the bureaucracy that we have in pretty much all of the civilized world now, what we need is this one world intergovernmental, or just a one world government, where there are apparently there's a bureaucracy on every level. This is what it's about, huh?
Well, it is. And in fact, I mean, if you look at the people who are still talking openly about world government or global governance, and there are a number of organizations out there that are promoting this, a lot of their spokespersons are saying that probably climate change is the most promising issue to create a sort of a global consensus mm-hmm. on the need for a world government, more so than the nuclear fears of a nuclear war, more so than
they went with the pandemic there for a while.
The
they
pandemic,
tried around
yeah,
with
but
that.
These are temporary things. I mean, you can't maintain a pandemic forever.
Well, they tried.
they tried, but you know, it's kind of faded from the public consciousness as these things do. Again, war hysteria is a big one, and for a long time, up through you know the 1980s, that was the thing. You need to have world government so that there's never a third world war.
Yeah,
you know, and that's kind of faded. And now they're putting all their eggs in this climate basket. I think because they feel that regardless of the inevitable financial, economic, social, cultural, political changes that are going to occur, the ebb and flow of international trade and all this stuff that goes on. You know, right now we're decoupling from China and all this stuff. Climate is an issue that's potentially, if they can gin up enough support, is transgenerational.
Mm-hmm.
So even if the glaciers still haven't melted and the city sunk beneath the waves 50 years from now, it's still an issue they can invoke. All they have to do is keep gently pushing their forecasts further and further into the indefinite future. But the threat is always there.
And we've reported pretty extensively on false predictions. And you mentioned Glacier. I used to live in Montana. We used to go out to Glacier National Park every year, a couple times a year or whatnot. And there is, I forget which one of the glaciers, there's a section there where they used to have the prediction that by such and such year, this glacier will be gone. Well, they had to change that because it was still there by that year. And you would think with all the predictions that have failed over and over, and now we have a record. It's not like you can't just go on the internet and find this. Clearly, it took us only a couple of hours to prepare for this show, and we found this stuff so easily. How come this may be rhetorical. Why in the world do people still believe this? Are they really uninformed?
Well, part of it is that people have information fatigue. So hardly anyone remembers the hysteria about the ozone hole of 30 years ago.
Good point.
Or thereabouts.
I remember that.
So the ozone hole, and even back then, you know, people like Dixie Lee Ray would point out, well, okay, so if the ozone hole is being created by industry, then why is it over the South Pole? Why isn't it up north? Why is the big ozone hole that appears every, you know, and is it perhaps coincidental that that part of the world, Antarctica, has more active volcanoes,
right,
you know, than the Arctic does, and so forth and so on. But, you know, again, you can't have it both ways. So the climate people argue that this is a global phenomenon. Okay, and in parts of the world, you can see places where the tides are now ocean. I was in the Philippines last year, and they told me I actually witnessed a tide coming over and covering this building. We actually ate lunch in 3 feet of water in picnic tables, and the people there said, "Well, it's only been doing this for a couple of years." So, oh my goodness, this must be climate change. And yet, in other parts of the world, there's no evidence this is happening. The thing is that the crust of the Earth subsides in some areas, and in other areas not. So that's a factor. But you can't have it both ways. So if the glaciers are melting in Glacier National Park, which, of course, some of them are receding. I mean, they have the pictures to prove that they have receded in the last 100 years. But in the southern hemisphere, I mean, I was also in southern Argentina in Tierra del Fuego last year. And there, glaciers like Perito Moreno are as robust as ever.
Yeah. Huh.
Perhaps more so. They seem to be inexhaustible.
Right.
So
depends.
There are local changes even in climate, maybe in a continent-wide scale. But globally, the evidence, I just don't see the evidence.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you very much. And we'll be back right after these messages.
Hi, I'm Alan Keyes. I'm the host of IMTV's daily talk show about news and events in America. And I want to say a good word for the New American magazine. Not only because Alex Newman has joined us as somebody who is periodically hosting a show, but because New American Magazine represents an alternative media that is willing to tell people the truth. With so much fake news spreading about, and the fact that right now this country's in an existential crisis, we remember who we are and where we come from and what our principles are, or we die. Reading New American Magazine can keep you up to the minute on the issues that are challenging us as a people and on which that survival hangs. You can check it out and subscribe at www.thenewamerican.com.
As a lumberjack, I've been cutting wood for decades. My job is pretty straightforward. I see the wood, I chop the wood. My axe goes through every time. You remember when everyone bought all the toilet paper? And they wanted me to wear these things? And someone invested a lot of money into this stuff. They say I'm part of a global plan. I don't think so. It's too hot, it's too cold. You know what? The weather changes. We even hear crazy ideas on how kids should learn.
Here's the news, Dad.
Is it, son? Is it?
What about this one, Dad?
Nope. It's hard to tell what's real and what's fake these days. There's just too much baloney out there. At the New American, they cut through the baloney and give me the truth.
Visit thenewamerican.com and subscribe to get 50% off the cover price. And if you want an even better deal, use the promo code 10OFFSUB. Again, that's 10OFFSUB for more than 50% off.
Welcome back. I'm excited to be joined by Dr. Duke Pesta. Dr. Pesta is the executive director of Freedom Project Academy. He's the host of the Dr. Duke Show, and he's a tenured professor of English at the University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh. He's one of the country's foremost authorities on critical race theory, the dangers of Common Core, and the federal takeover of education. Welcome, Duke.
Hey, Paul, how you doing?
Thanks for coming back, and you know, we'll tell our audience that we hope to have you regularly. So what's going on out there in the educational / cultural realm?
Sure, there's always so much going on. We could spend hours and hours every day, 5 days a week. But something I would like to alert your viewers to is that we talked a lot about, and in various other formats as well, about how controlling the schools are getting, how they're sacrificing actual education for ideology, the sex ed, this critical race theory. They're making public schools really sociological experiment petri dishes to mess with your kids' minds. But what we haven't talked a lot about is how the public schools, once they take your kids and they remake them in their own image, then they send them back or they bully them to become activists. And I want to talk a little bit about that today, how the bad education your kids are getting, the sociological education, is now becoming very fruitful to the left because these kids become activists. And I want to give you an example. We have a story about civil rights teams. Interesting, CRT, but a different meaning.
Yeah, different.
Civil rights teams that are terrorizing public schools in Maine. We have groups of kids who are part of the civil rights committee in school. And what these kids are doing is they're taking their marching orders from teachers and administrators, and they are literally bullying kids on campus who
this
do not—
This is K through 12?
This is K through 12. This is middle school. Kids who do not fully conform to the LGBTQ imperatives being imposed on them, they get bullied, often beaten up, threatened. This is happening right now.
This is happening in K through 12 taxpayer-funded schools.
Yeah, this is in Maine, the state of Maine. One example, in Maine, school-sanctioned bands of radicalized students dubbed civil rights teams have terrorized other children who do not kowtow to gender and sexuality ideology, which is imposed by school officials. One mother by the name of Kristen Day sounded this alarm. She talked about how critics that her daughter, who was cornered by these kids, a gang of them, and she was told that you listen to gay music, you should be gay. At one point, they said to her, threatened her, you at least need to be bisexual to be in this school, open-minded to all sexes, or else. And so the threatening nature of this, it's kind of a goon squad to enforce the LGBTQ.
But you're saying the school officials have, in a way, sponsored this.
Well, this is a formal club on campus. The civil rights teams are administratively recognized clubs that these kids go. They're sponsored by teachers. Yeah. And they're going around now with that imprimatur, that authority, bullying and actually attacking kids who don't fall in line.
You know, there was an op-ed or some sort of an article in Chronicles magazine not too long ago, and it talked about how we're creating this insurgent class. And it was talking about, it was in the context of what happened in 2020 with the riots and things like that, all the anti-Americanism, the intersexuality. And I think it mentioned part of the K-12 education. Obviously, we know academia has been doing this for a long time, but is this, as far as in K-12, is there a difference, I guess, in academia? Would you say it's been happening longer, and now they're moving it through K-12? Do you see this ramping up even more to where it comes out of Maine and it just starts to overtake?
This is much bigger than Maine, and you made a very important point. The universities have been doing this for a long time.
Yeah.
Who is Antifa? It is primarily disaffected college kids, college-age people. So that radical violence is, to some degree, fostered in the universities.
Mm-hmm.
But now, as with the educational paradigm, what we were doing in education at the college level 30 years ago to radicalize kids, now with things like Common Core, we've imported that down to the high school, the middle, and even the elementary school. So we should not be surprised to realize that as we begin to do to little kids what we did with college kids, now those kids are behaving the same way as college kids, violence. And you see what the story I just gave you. And there's a horrible story from two weeks ago, where we had elementary school kids, young African-American elementary school kids, who were bullying younger elementaries. You're about fifth graders bullying second graders. What they were doing on video for this, they were dragging little kids and making them kneel down and proclaim their loyalty to Black Lives Matter. Kids were running away and were being grabbed and dragged back, pushed to their knees, and one kid was punched in the head. This was about, we're talking fifth graders persecuting second graders. Elementary school kids. And where do they get that from? There's no place they get that from other than their schools. And this was during a recess at a local middle school, an elementary school where this was going on.
Is Black Lives Matter, obviously it was really trendy from 20 to 21. And then it seemed like as some of the scams broke out, you know, of course, like typical communists, the leaders, they hoarded all this money. They got themselves big palaces on the beach where, like, off in the ocean in California and whatnot. And they're like, where did all that money go? Is Black Lives Matter still a thing? Is it still trending?
Yes, it is, in the sense that all the universities are teaching it. And like you said, they're no longer a street movement. They are a intellectual and academic movement. So Hollywood still pushes it. Law schools push it. The universities push it. But think about it. The reason that you're not hearing from them is because there have not really been an egregious shooting of a Black person by a white cop. That's the only time you're going to hear them. The next time a white cop kills a Black suspect, even if it's justified, you'll see them again.
You think so?
Meanwhile, what, hundreds of African Americans are killed in Chicago by other African Americans every week, and nothing from Black Lives Matter. In fact, their main purpose, I think, from a Soros perspective, if I may use that term, was simply to turn people against police. And so the next time something happens from a police perspective, you'll see them again. And that should tell you something. The fact that we haven't heard from them in 2 years, year and a half, tells you how rare these instances of racialized shooting of Black people by cops actually is.
Well, it's extremely rare. I don't know if I mentioned this last time you and I talked. There is a 2021 study or report from the Manhattan Institute. And what it looked like, it made a case for it's a social construction where one of the questions they asked Black folks or people in general was, do you believe more Black folks are killed by cops, by white cops, or in car accidents? And a great deal of them thought that they were killed more by police officers, when of course it's so far from the truth. It is rare. And this, I would say, this is what propaganda is they take these instances and they say, say, and they paint this broad brush and they say, this is what's happening. This is the condition of the entire country. They obviously, they want to build that insurgent class that then comes out in the streets and topples society. Do you think, I mean, from the educational perspective and you being in academia, is there awareness or is it okay to think that this is an attempt to topple Western society in America?
Yeah, it has no other purpose. I mean, what you said was very right, spot on. I mean, this is propaganda. It's why it's only trotted out when you have a visual display. Black Lives Matter, nobody pays attention to it until you have people in the streets, till you have looting and rioting, until you have a cop that you can persecute and dox. Yeah. So you'll see it again. And this is part of a much larger concerted effort. This is what critical race theory is. Critical race theory is quite literally propagandizing race, bringing racism back because so that you can fight it, you can pretend to fight it. We have little kids. You mentioned children that study that you cited. People believe it. People actually believe that we are worse racially now than we were in 1860. That now it's slavery and its offshoots are more dangerous than they've ever been in American history. If you could just simply demonstrate to people it's a lie, all this critical race theory would go away in a second, but everybody believes it because that's what our teachers are teaching from elementary school all the way through graduate school.
Well, what's crazy is they call it systemic racism. Now, like when you use the word systemic, if it's anything, it's not systemic because, you know, if you look at affirmative action, you could say, okay, it's racism, but I would call that reverse racism. But other than that, there is no systemic. You know, you can't. You're not allowed to not hire someone based on race. Everything in the system is equalized.
It's not even equal. Everything is tilted now to the minority.
They've overcorrected.
Exactly, overcorrected. You mentioned affirmative action. Do we have all black colleges? Yes. Do we have all white colleges?
No.
If we are a systemically racist country, we are bad at it. Name another. If we really a white supremacist country, how is it possible that 85% of our immigrants, legal and illegal, over the last 50 years have been non-white? How does that work?
Right.
Number one, that's one. If we are a systemically racist country, why is it that we're the most diverse country in the history of the world?
Well, we elected a half-black president twice.
Twice.
And it's sure not because of the black vote, because the black folks represent, 12% of the population, right? And obviously, they didn't all vote for Obama anyway. So let's say 10%. That's still not enough to put... You know, the math doesn't add up.
A huge predominance of white people had to vote for that black president, and they did. Twice they voted for him.
Right, exactly.
And so this idea, if we are a systemically racist country, it doesn't make any sense. Why do brown and black-skinned people keep coming here if it is what the professors say it is? I mean, if you got here, let's say you came across...
Why can't we control the border?
Well, exactly.
Right.
If you sailed across the channel from Cuba to Florida, and the minute you got here, you found out that you couldn't work, you couldn't go to... Your kids couldn't go to school.
Right.
You were not allowed to go to hospitals. Yeah, you'd go back.
Right.
You wouldn't keep coming. But they come and they stay because, you know what? For a systemically racist country, they sure have it a lot better than the Castros or the people in Venezuela or the Chinese treat them.
Right.
They come here because regardless of their race, they can get ahead. As you said it, this is the least systemically racist country in the history of the world.
We got a few minutes left here. I want to touch on you again with your background. I'd like to know, with critical theory or critical race theory, having been in academia so long, was there anyone raising the alarm bells about it, you know, decades ago or not? Or
the schools and the universities have been so completely overrun for 60 years now. This is why we're losing the culture, Paul. I really believe it, because at every level, public education belongs exclusively to progressives, not even moderate Democrats. From kindergarten and preschool programs all the way through law schools, graduate programs, PhD programs, the progressive left owns all of it.
They've captured it.
And you know, right? Hitler said the same thing that Mao said, the same thing that Stalin said. Give us the universities. Give us the elementary schools. Alinsky said this.
Yeah.
Bill Ayers said this in his biography of Obama. Give us the schools, and we will transform your culture. And Lincoln, who was on our side more or less, said exactly the same thing. He said, whatever controls the classroom in one generation, just one generation, becomes the whole country in the next generation. So how you bring up your kids will determine your longevity as a society. And if that's true, we don't have a lot of time left.
Well, I guess that was going to be my last point is, are we past the point of no return? Because, hold on, think about it. I think it speaks also to the strength of Americanism and Republicanist ideas and ideas of liberty that despite academia and all of media having been captured so long ago, they still haven't completely taken the society. You know, I think there's a lot of people that grow up, they come out of academia, and they realize this was crap.
Sure.
You know?
I think the reason it's not the end of the world yet is that we still have private schools, although many of them have been co-opted, and we have homeschooling. It won't be the end until they get rid of those. But that's why you're already hearing more noise about attacking homeschools.
Yes, we
are. And let's do this. When we see you next week, let's talk about that. Now, how is the progressive left, who's nailing that, how are they turning around? And now that they've got control, now they're coming for your homeschools.
Oh.
But as long as our kids are free to be educated outside, there's always hope.
Thank you, Duke. And I look forward to hearing about how they're – well, actually, I don't look forward to that, but I think we need to hear about how they're attacking homeschools.
Thanks, Paul.
Well, thank you for joining us, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Sophia paused before the door. It read, Department of Bi-Digital Convergence. Just inside was a new world, a better world, the one of everlasting life, of no pain, of no loss, of no problem. She entered the chamber, and her surroundings changed. She saw around her an infinite field of waving golden grain surmounted by cloudless blue sky. The AI voice whispered gently in her mind, Welcome to the Singularity. She couldn't see it and couldn't feel it, but her body had almost instantly been covered by a swarm of tiny gray multi-legged bots that melted through her clothes and into her skin. Not perceiving the nightmare, her eyes had already been consumed and the rest of her body was dissolving as the bots digested her flesh. She felt only a warmth suffusing her being. Drowsy, she drifted to sleep, and her last thought was one of panic. Would she ever wake? Could a nightmare vision like this be an outcome of the much-hyped transhumanist technological singularity? Enter the world of the future as illuminated by the experience of the past in Endgame, the new book by Dennis Barrett, the publisher of The New American Magazine, and find out how the disastrous COVID pandemic response fits with the technocratic elite's thirst to create a transhumanist utopia. Get Endgame from shopjbs.org with free shipping with code ENDSHIP, ENDSHIP. Or get Endgame and the Great Reset Collector's Issue of The New American Magazine and get free shipping plus an additional 20% off both with code N20, END20.
Next up, we're going to show you the powerful testimony of Nikki Gozer, Executive Director of the Crime Prevention Research Center. Her husband was gunned down in a gun-free zone. Gozer testified before the Michigan State Senate Judiciary Committee on March 2nd. She was a concealed carry license holder at the time, but her and her husband were made victims in a local restaurant due to the unintended but inevitable consequences of gun control laws. Let's watch.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm here speaking as a victim of a violent crime, a crime that some call gun violence. I call it violence because I realize violence is a behavior, not an object. I do not hate guns or gun ownership. I understand that guns serve a legitimate purpose for the basic human right of self-defense. I want to give you some insight on how red flag laws or extreme risk protection orders, while intended to protect people, can have very real unintended consequences for many Americans like myself, victims. I'm going to try to get through this without crying. In 2009, my husband, Ben, was shot 7 times and killed in front of me by a man who I only realized that very night was stalking me. This occurred inside a restaurant in Nashville, Tennessee, that was a gun-free zone. Because of that law, at that time, I had to leave my legal permitted firearm that I normally carried for self-defense locked inside of my vehicle that night. I obeyed that gun control law. I'm a law-abiding citizen. My stalker, however, did not. He had no permit to carry. He brought a gun in illegally into the middle of a gun-free zone. And when I asked management to please remove him because I realized I was being stalked, when they confronted him and asked him to leave, he pulled a .45 from a shoulder holster and shot my husband 7 times in front of myself and everyone in the middle of that busy restaurant. I'll probably wonder for the rest of my life if I could have prevented that. Of course, I'll never know because I was denied a chance. I was stalked and defenseless. Just like the Michigan State University shooter who should have been prosecuted for gun possession felony and other crimes, the legal system failed by not arresting and prosecuting my stalker years before he ever came to Tennessee. He should have been a convicted felon and a prohibited person. And the people in his life who knew him, you know, years before he ever came to Tennessee, they should have had him involuntarily committed. I learned so many things during the murder trial, and it was obvious that this guy had real issues and they should have been addressed, and there were laws that would have made that possible, but people just did not use the existing law, and I don't understand why. The legal system failed Ben and I was also prevented from being able to protect us. The days, months, and years that followed were very difficult for me. Depression, nightmares, grief, trauma, loss, and concern for my safety were all things that I dealt with and had to work through. These were all normal human reactions to something this horrific. I had knelt in a pool of my husband's blood, trying to pray the life back into him. I heard screaming and screaming until I realized that screaming was actually coming from me. I had to wipe away my husband's brain matter from coming out of his nostrils. It was a last act to try and preserve some kind of dignity for him before the crime scene photographer with Metro got there. I had Ben's dried blood under my fingernails for days. I remember thinking during this time that if I just happened to pass away in my sleep, I would be okay with that because I didn't know how I could face another day. I was never suicidal, but you can see where someone may misinterpret that. Even those with the best of intentions could have an exaggerated concern and try to have my guns taken from me if a red flag law were in place in my state with no due process up front and no mental health expert involved. It would be devastating for a victim like myself to be unable to protect myself after this stalker violated me in such a horrific and life-altering way. I've been hearing that there are no means to act right now if someone is a danger to themselves or others. This is simply not true. There are currently involuntary commitment laws that already exist in every state in this nation. People just need to use them. There is first a mental health evaluation. And look, I would have had the opportunity under that existing law to explain why taking away my guns would make my situation actually much worse. I'd also have the opportunity in a hearing to explain to a judge that I'm not a danger to myself or others. I'm actually a victim of a horrific crime, and I'm dealing with normal emotions. I shouldn't lose my basic human right of self-defense. That would be trauma on top of trauma for me. Look, if someone is truly a danger to themselves, simply taking away their gun is not a serious solution. There are many ways to commit suicide. Anyone truly determined will simply find another way. If someone is a danger to others, only taking away their guns does not prevent them from harming or killing others. Look, when the police searched my stalker's vehicle at the crime scene, not only did they find 2 more guns and ammunition, they also found a baseball bat, binoculars, gloves, rope, and a knife. His Dodge Ram truck could have been used as a weapon as well. As a stalking victim, I can tell you it is extremely important to be able to obtain protection quickly and be able to carry. safe storage laws sound like common sense until you realize being forced to lock up your gun more than locking it in a glove box. You are making it so that women who are the most vulnerable to be victims of crime will have no way to quickly defend themselves. Should we tell the bad guy who intends to rape us and kill us, stop, wait, let me unlock my gun and load the magazine first before you attack me? The criminal justice system will not protect you. I know this firsthand. My stalker has continued stalking me from prison by sending me twisted love letters for years. He is currently set to be released early because of good behavior early release credits in 2028. That's absolutely terrifying for me. I believe women should be empowered to protect themselves how they see fit. The women of Michigan should have the right to choose what will work best to protect them and their loved ones. I fear that these gun control laws that are being proposed will have real unintended consequences and cost lives. I have seen firsthand the consequences of laws that prevent good people from being able to protect themselves. In conclusion, please focus on mental health care, funding and education about the existing involuntary commitment laws for families and law enforcement. Improve the criminal justice system so that those who break the law are actually held accountable, charged, and prosecuted correctly. Prisons being a revolving door for violent offenders is hurting us all. If it saves just one life, in gun-free zones that are, they're not, where there's no security, and you say no one can be there to defend themselves, you know, that makes good people helpless. What good is owning a gun if you cannot carry it with you to protect yourself? You're a law-abiding citizen. You've passed the background check. You've got your permit to carry. You've done everything. You've practiced. Why? Why can't you carry? If it saves just one life, please don't force women to lock up their gun, preventing them from quickly defending themselves when needed. Please, please stop and think of the other side of these laws and the victims that you could be creating, victims of gun control. Thank you.
If Americans want to remain a free and sovereign nation, more people need to understand the principles and values that built this great nation. At the John Birch Society, we have the organization, the plan, and the resources to do just that. Our founder, Robert Welch, said, "Education is our total strategy and truth our only weapon." Go to jbs.org to learn more, including how you can get involved to work locally and impact nationally. Join the John Birch Society today.
Next up is another installment in our ongoing discussion about principles with Gary Benoit and Steve Bonta. Today's principle: life is paramount.
Hello, this is Gary Benoit, and with me today is Executive Senior Editor for the New America Magazine, Steve Bonta, to talk about principles. Steve, welcome to the program.
Hi, Gary. Great to be here.
Now, today you want to talk about the principle that human life is paramount, particularly individual human life is paramount.
Yes, well, the right to life is paramount. And so, I mean, we've sort of laid...
Should we start over, by the way, since I muffed that?
Go ahead.
Sure. Restart. Okay, quickly. Sorry. We're still rolling, so okay. Okay. This is Gary Benoit, and with me today is Steve Bonta, Executive Senior Editor of the New American Magazine, to talk about principles. Steve, welcome to the program.
Hi, Gary. Great to be here.
Well, thank you. And the principle you'd like to talk about today, Steve, is that the right to life is paramount.
Okay, well, I mean, this will be a part of a series mm-hmm. of rights. We've kind of, the broader purpose of this little these little chats is to sort of lay out principles. And in an earlier principle, we alluded to the idea of natural law and natural rights. And then we talked more recently about individuals and the way in which, you know, you can't really understand natural laws and natural rights unless they inhere in something, mm-hmm. namely the individual. So now we come around to the question of, well, precisely what kinds of rights in here in the individual. And there are a number of them. And a very strong, compelling argument could be made that the so-called right to life is probably the most important, the most fundamental. Mm-hmm. It is the first of the three listed by Thomas Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Yes. Of course, those are not all-encompassing. It says among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Then it proceeds to list a couple of other rights, like the right to sever contact with the, you know, dissolve the bonds with the previous government, all that sort of thing. So there are actually several rights, like five or six rights that are mentioned. Mm-hmm. But life is first. And so why should that be so important? And why, for that matter, should we spend our time talking about it? Because it seems, again, self-evident to so many of our viewers. Well, first of all, because it's not being treated as a paramount right, okay, as witness the fact that we are being systematically deprived of the legal right to defend ourselves through constant flagitious violations of the Second Amendment. So obviously in the views of those who would be our masters in the government, maybe right to life is important, but not important enough to actually guarantee us the right to self-defense that the Founding Fathers intended. And what about abortion? And this kind of thing.
Right. Well, of course, in the world we live in today, many people consider abortion to be a right.
Well, that's an absolute obscenity.
Oh, I know.
And we'll probably talk about that in more detail in another installment. But all of these things, you know, suggest that maybe in the views of the elites, that the right to life really isn't that important. And perhaps that's so because for them individuality is not important and God is not important and all the other things that we've talked about.
Right.
But if those things are important, as we maintain and as the founders steadfastly maintained as well, then surely the right to life is the most important of them all. Because in some sense, and obviously different religions perhaps disagree on what the precise purpose of life is, but we all concur in saying that this life is important.
Right.
It's fundamentally important. And again, just a brief reference to something we talked about in a previous episode. If you compare the Western Judeo-Christian perspective on the value of human life, at least in the traditional sense, with non-Western religions, you find again that there's a difference. And there's reasons for this. So many non-Western religions, for example, believe in some form of reincarnation, which might seem harmless enough, except that if it's true that we are going to be reincarnated endlessly to sort of self-atone for whatever mistakes we made in a previous life, build up karma, whatever terminology you choose, then that implies that this life is not necessarily that important. Right, because because I'm going to be reborn again and again and again. So why worry about making this life anything of great consequence?
Sure. Now we could go to the opposite end of the spectrum and look at people who are atheists, people who are materialists, and they believe that in a sense man is no more than organic robots. That there is no eternal soul, and so. Why would that philosophy respect life?
Right. And what people don't understand is that these ideas have consequences. Well, beliefs have consequences, religious beliefs in particular. And so, for example, I spent quite a bit of my time long ago when I was a graduate student in a certain part of the world. There was a lot of poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And I would see things that really shocked me. I would see small children begging in the streets, sometimes bearing scars of abuse of various kinds. I would see people with horrible illnesses lying unattended in the streets. And I couldn't understand this, you know. And the explanation that a lot of people arrived at, well, this is a poor country. They don't have the resources to care for people like that. But in fact, you know, there are a lot of poor countries in the world where these things are prioritized. And I finally realized, it was explained to me once by more than once, person, well, you got to understand, our belief is that beggar child or that man with leprosy or whatever, that he's that way because of something he did in a previous life.
Mm-hmm.
And his duty in this life is to, in a sense, accept his fate. And then if he does it well, then in the next life, he'll be reborn possibly as a movie star or a politician or somebody else, you know, of privileged status. He'll be rewarded for it. So in that kind of a framework, this life really doesn't matter. Human life doesn't matter. You know, the reason that we value life so much is that we understand that this life, right now, whatever its purpose may be, is of limited, of finite duration. And so we feel a moral obligation to defend it, to protect it, to do anything we can. Even the child who's suffering from some terminal disease, we irrationally, as it may seem to some, stop at nothing to try to prolong that child's life, right? We say, those of us who are pro-life will say, so what if a child is born with some mental handicap or something like that? They're still a child of God, and this life is just as precious for them as it is for you or me or anyone else. And this is,
of course. This
whole idea of people being equal under God is bound up in this idea that each one of us in our respective lives, in our respective lifelines, as the physicists like to say, is perhaps of equal and eternal worth, right? And then in some sense, this mortal life, we may not understand the precise purpose, but it is of transcendent importance in the cosmic scheme of things. And therefore, the right to life and the right to defense of life and the right to live as full a life as possible, and the right to have the means to develop whatever our individual potential happens to be, and even perhaps to make mistakes and hopefully learn from those mistakes.
Right.
All of these things just become sacrosanct when the right to life is enshrined as a central, primordial, unalienable individual right.
Right. And by contrast, I'd like to go back once again to the atheistic point of view or the materialistic point of view, because looking at it from that point of view, God is not a creator. There is no God. And so what does the difference say between a human being or, let's say, a sheep or a cow or a dog or a cat or even a microorganism? What is the difference? And if you look how animals may be treated, we eat beef, for example. We eat chickens. We wouldn't do that to man, obviously. Man is considered very different. But from the communist point of view, man is just nothing. He's just an organic robot who presumably can be shaped by his environment as to what he thinks and how he behaves. And people can be treated just like cattle are treated.
Sure. In fact, the French revolutionary theorist Saint-Just once famously said, "The people are nothing more than a herd that needs to be told where to browse." Now, that was more than 200 years ago.
Right.
So that same mentality has been reconditioned in the modern age with this idea that we're nothing more than meat machines.
But what a difference, what a stark difference between that horrible philosophy and the beliefs of the teachings of Jesus Christ.
Indeed.
Well, thank you very much, Steve.
Thank you, Gary.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to The New American TV. And remember to visit thenewamerican.com for more truth behind the news. Have a good weekend, and we'll see you on Monday.